dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, W201CD Ithaca Community Radio at 88.1 FM, Free Radio Santa Cruz, or KFAR Knoxville. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. Last week, the felony trial of the St. Patrick's Day 4 began. The defendants, pacifists of the Ithaca Catholic worker community, poured blood at the Military Recruiting Center in Lansing, New York on March 17, 2003 as part of nationwide efforts by Americans to prevent the invasion of Iraq by the U.S. government. As we reported last week, Tompkins County Judge John Sherman barred the defense from bringing expert witnesses to testify on international law. This removed a key component of the activists' defense, which was that they did what they did because as citizens they were obligated, under international law, to prevent the illegal invasion of Iraq by the U.S. government. One of the witnesses who was barred from testifying was historian Howard Zinn, but you'll hear him on the program tonight, discussing how a knowledge of history is essential if citizens want to get to the truth behind the patriotic rhetoric of presidents bent on war. As a result of Judge Sherman's ruling, the defense had no witnesses other than the activists themselves, who all took the stand and questioned each other regarding their intentions behind the actions of protest they took. They are charged with a felony, criminal mischief in the third degree, which carries a maximum 4-year jail term, and the intent of the perpetrator is at issue under this charge, as defendants, in order to be guilty, must have knowledge that they had no right to damage the property at issue, nor any reasonable belief that they had such a right. The four defendants are acting as their own attorneys, with advisory counsel present but not speaking in court. The judge has allowed the four to speak extensively about their beliefs and understanding of international laws that motivated their actions. Last Monday, the trial began with jury selection that turned into a debate on the war in Iraq as defendants questioned prospective jurors on their political beliefs and biases. Both the bailiff of the court as well as advisory counsel Professor of Law William Quigley said they had never seen anything like it. The courtroom was packed each day with community supporters, and most agreed the testimony of the people on trial was eloquent. Members of the district attorney's office apparently agreed as well. Several attorneys from the DA's office who were watching in the audience also expressed fears that the prosecution would not prevail. The defense rested on Friday, and closing arguments and the judge's instructions to the jury are expected to be presented tomorrow, April 12th. According to the defense, the prosecution is asking the judge to tell the jury that they may convict the defendants on a lesser charge, which they hope will avoid a hung jury. Defendants are opposing this instruction as it is seen as lessening their chances for acquittal. The judge will announce his decision on this point tomorrow. One troubling development over the weekend is that defendant Peter DeMott was rushed to the hospital and diagnosed with a brain hemorrhage. He is presently at the Cayuga Medical Center in stable condition, as of the latest information available to me. I will be preparing an extensive report on this historic trial for a future program, but this week I offer you a couple of excerpts from this week's testimony, just to give you some of the flavor. In the clips you'll hear, defendant Teresa Grady is on the stand, first being questioned by co-defendant Claire Grady. Then, a clip from prosecutor Jennifer Worrell's cross-examination of Teresa Grady.
International law from the Nuremberg trials, coming out of the German experience, we found people to be saying, "I just did what I was told," or "I was just following the law." And those trials brought about decisions that were made, and thus treaties signed by our government that said that citizens, if they have the ability to speak out against injustice and criminal behavior on the part of their government, are required. Otherwise, they will be equally culpable for the crimes of their government. And understanding that, I felt not just the moral obligation, but in fact, the legal grounds for that.
Thank you, Teresa. Did you believe that the imminent war with Iraq was illegal?
I did.
And in your opinion, what effect does war have on this country?
Well, economically, I think we all can say very fairly that everything is being cut, that taxes are going up, and I don't think it's unfair to say that the taxes are going up because there's no money in the coffers of our government because they've been sent off to war. And I think that if people want to complain about there not being any money here and that we don't have enough money to fix our roads or to have youth bureau activities, I know the WIC program here has been cut in half. The director has had to go part-time for the Tompkins County WIC program, which is the Women and Infants and Children Center, which helps to supply good nutrition to people of this county, women and infants and children. And also the Ithaca Youth Bureau has been cut so that our young people are not being served for extra support in their growth and development.
Were you aware of these effects prior to March 17?
Yes, I was, and I would add that these effects are also a moral and psychological oppression to our people to know that we may be causing harm and death to other people who are innocent. I think that creates a great weight on all of our psyches, and so that's another cost of this war. The other effect is to our military, our young men and women who often go to war when our country sends them. And the effect that has on our people, I feel that our military people is, I think, probably the greatest moral, it's actually, I don't even know if I can use words to describe it, but what I feel shame when we have asked young people to go off and to kill and to be killed for illegal reasons, for non-noble reasons, as I would call them. I feel very great shame because I know that when people go off to kill, it hurts their being. And when they come home, as I have been speaking with a young GI, David Miller is his name, and he is in the Army Reserves. He's 3 years before retirement, and he's saying to me, because I've had a number of conversations with him now, he's just come back. I believe it was December that he arrived back. He says, "We're spent. I've been in the first Gulf War. I've been in Bosnia. I've been in Afghanistan, and now this latest Iraqi war." And this man and I don't agree on war in terms of military, but he talks about the fact that he doesn't think that they should have been sent to Iraq. And not only does he not feel that they should have been sent to Iraq, but now that they're returning home, he's part of a group of men where he's in fact the one supporting a lot of families in the Bronx. He's a contractor, and
well, it was about the effects that she knows of a war, and I think we're we can do this with a little less detail, perhaps, about every aspect of this man's life. I think we could summarize it pretty well.
I see the repeating issue, which is that, and this is the stories of David Joy from the Bronx right now, saying that, in fact, it was just last week, the Army reservists who were killed in Iraq, their bodies were sent home to their families in the Bronx. There were two of them that were from the Bronx. And the families were given $900 to bury their dead. These families don't have medical insurance. They have no money to pay their rents. They're being evicted. And this is what David is telling me. And he is angry. And he's saying, why aren't they taking care of us? And this man still believes that wars are necessary. And so we have very different opinions on that. But he is telling me that they are spent. They've killed people in ways that he would never even want to describe to me, is what he said. I don't want to, I would never tell you.
Next question.
I think I'm going to end with a question. Very briefly, could you tell us your feelings toward the troops on the ground in Iraq, just briefly?
My feelings are sorrow, first of all, because of what's going on right now as we speak in the cities where the pillage is going on in an intensity that may even be greater than Shalk and all, I don't know. Ground troops, combat hand to hand. To me, my feeling is sorrow, and my desire is for them to come home.
Teresa Grady being questioned by defendant Claire Grady in court last week. Next, cross-examination by Deputy DA Jennifer Worrell.
When you got there, all four of you went in, and did you go to the right once you walked into the door?
Actually, I went directly forward, and the intention was to pour it along the wall to let the blood drip down the wall. That was what our plan was. That's what we had talked about.
Okay. So you had an intention when you went in there to pour it on up on the top of the wall?
The top of the wall, so it would come down and we could see the blood.
Okay. And in fact, you did pour your blood on the wall?
I poured Peter and Danny's blood on the wall.
Okay. Did you pour it on the front window if you're looking in?
I eventually got around, because I went straight back to the wall and then went around to the right, to the little wall, and then the glass.
Did you pour the blood on any posters?
To be honest, I don't remember, but there was blood, and so I could have been one of those people.
Okay.
I would like to say that it was quite perverse to look at those beautiful service people on those posters with the blood streaming down their face, and it only made me realize that, in fact, war is perverse.
Judge, I would ask that that be stricken from the record. It's not unresponsive.
Well, I think it was responsive, Counsel. Please, go ahead, next turn, ask a question.
Do you recall when Sergeant, you were no longer in the lobby when Sergeant Montgomery came out, correct?
I don't.
It's beyond the scope of
the Well, I think she's entitled to ask her about her participation. We've raised the fact that why she went there. I think no one on cross, she's certainly entitled to ask what happened when she went there.
Okay, I'm fine with answering the question. Yeah.
Okay, go ahead, Ms. Warren. I'm fine with it too. That's what's going to happen.
Thank you, Your Honor.
You wanted to know if Mr. Montgomery had come out while I was still in the lobby.
Correct. When Sergeant Montgomery came, were you outside?
I believe that he came out when my back was to him. I was on the right hand side wall.
Okay. The first time he came out, you were still in the lobby.
I believe so. I remember him saying, I don't remember the exact words, but I remember him thinking, what's going on here? And his comment was that of asking us to stop, and we said in good conscience we needed to.
Okay. So he asked you to stop putting blood on the property, correct?
Yeah, I don't know that he used that word, but...
In some substance.
Yes.
And you refused to do so.
Correct.
Do you recall that he asked you to leave?
No, I don't recall that.
At some point after that, you went outside, correct?
Yes.
Okay, yes. Yeah. And you threw blood on the sidewalk outside?
I did not throw blood anywhere.
Did you witness who threw the blood on the sidewalk outside?
I don't think anyone threw blood.
I think she's objecting to the verb.
Okay. Yes.
Did you pour blood on the sidewalk?
I did not.
Did you see who did put the blood on the sidewalk?
I didn't see anyone doing it, but I believe Claire did it, so that...
And
yeah.
Did you put the body bag also on the sidewalk?
It was brought to me by the outer group, and so I put it in front of where Claire and I were kneeling and praying.
When you went to the recruiting station, you were aware that blood stains, correct?
I know that blood does stain. I know it's easy to clean as well.
Were you aware that, so you were aware that the property would have to be cleaned, correct?
That was not part of what my focus was that day.
Did it cross your mind at all that the property would have to be cleaned?
No, it did not. Not that it wouldn't be a logical thing, but certainly it wasn't what my focus or intent was.
And did you yourself call up any of the employees at the recruiting station and ask them if you could come and pour blood around the lobby?
I didn't believe that I needed to ask what I, as a citizen, felt compelled to do.
Is the answer
no? I need permission from them.
Did you call and ask for
it?
Did you ask permission from New Plan Realty, the owners of the building, to pour your blood throughout the lobby?
As a citizen of conscience, I believe that I had the right to do what I did.
Is the answer no?
The answer is no.
Did you call and let them know that you were coming?
I did not.
Did you call anyone from the district attorney's office and say, this is what we plan on doing, we think it's legal, are we going to be prosecuted?
I didn't believe that that was what I needed to be doing, so no, I did not.
Did you call the police and let them know of your plans and ask them if you were going to be arrested?
I assumed that that was a possibility, a big probability, but I did not call the police, no.
Okay. I want to talk to you a minute. You mentioned the Nuremberg principles. Those are based on the premise that if your government asks you to take an affirmative action, you can refuse to do so. Isn't that correct? To avoid being held accountable under international law?
You know, I can't answer that honestly because I would need to have them right in front of me to answer you with conviction. And as far as, I think what you're trying, I mean, I guess I'll just leave it at that. So if you wanted to bring them to me and I could look at them and then answer your question. I'm not an expert on the law, but what I do understand of them is, say your question again.
My question was, you raised Nuremberg principles.
Yes.
And my question to you is, aren't those principles based on the premise that if the government asks you to do an affirmative act, you can refuse to do so to avoid liability under international law?
Okay, yes, I guess I could agree with that.
And what was the affirmative act that you were being asked to do?
Pay my taxes.
Pay your taxes.
Yes, which supports that Army Recruiting Center.
So you went to the recruiting station to protest paying your taxes?
No, I was not protesting taxes. I was protesting the use of my money, of my tax dollars, in that recruiting center. That recruiting center represents our government. We are a government of the people, by the people, and for the people. And therefore, I had an obligation to show my opposition as a citizen who pays their taxes to say no, because otherwise I would have been culpable to what went on and is continuing to go on in Iraq right now.
So you felt you were going to be held liable under international law for paying your taxes?
Well, ask and answer.
think so. Suspended.
Why didn't you simply just stop paying your taxes? Why did you have to go and damage property?
Because I believe that there are things in our federal government that do deserve to have money to be paid for and supported by me.
Indeed, as the yearly income tax deadline approaches, many people are asking themselves the same question, whether they in good conscience can pay taxes that they know will go to fund war-making, war crimes, and war profiteering by the administration and their cronies. Perhaps inadvertently, Deputy D.A. Worrell's question highlighted the fact citizens are left with no legal effective means to oppose the actions of government. Many people who turned out to protest for the first time in their lives against this war in some of the mass mobilizations that took place last year found themselves met not only with batons, tear gas, and stampeding police horses, but with representatives that paid them no heed. This year, for the first time, many people are considering war tax resistance. According to the National War Tax Resistance Coordinating Committee, which has been in existence for 25 years, tax protests are scheduled in more than 50 cities. As an example, in Portland, Oregon, protesters will gather at Pioneer Courthouse Square wearing barrels and not much else. Their message: military spending has stripped us of our resources for schools, health care, etc. Newtrick says that a new group of people are considering resistance for the first time. One caller from Albuquerque, New Mexico, told them, "I just can't give them more for this war." Well-known poet and professor emeritus at the University of Pittsburgh, Dennis Brutus, is one of these people. In regard to his federal tax bill, he said, "I am prepared to pay taxes where these are due, but have decided not to pay taxes that will be used to purchase arms for immoral and unjust actions, such as the invasion and occupation of Iraq, among many other actions. I am prepared to become a tax resister to protest the use of taxes for unjust and immoral military action. I am willing to pay legitimate taxes if this can be agreed upon, and have asked to know what percentage of my taxes will be used for military purposes, and have not yet received information." Generally speaking, 60% of the tax dollar goes toward military and related expenditures. While Defense Secretary Rumsfeld testified July 9, 2003, to the Senate Armed Services Committee that the war in Iraq is costing about $3.9 billion a month, the administration said in February that it could not estimate the cost of war. Instead, they announced that a request for paying for the war would come, quote, after the elections, and would be about $50 billion. If you'd like to find out more about war tax resistance, contact Ruth Benn of the National War Tax Resistance Coordinating Committee, NUTRIC, at toll-free number 800-269-7464, 800-269-7464, or email nwtrcc@nwtrcc.org. That stands for NUTRIC, National War Tax Resistance Coordinating Committee. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, W201CD Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, or KFAR, Knoxville. Next, Professor Howard Zinn, author of The People's History of the United States, speaking last November in Los Angeles.
I want to talk about history, of course, and I want to talk about now, because I never wanted to separate the two. I didn't get into history because I wanted to be a professional historian. You know, I didn't want to just write for scholarly journals. I and go to annual meetings of the American Historical Association. You can imagine how fascinating that is. No, I went into history with sort of very modest aim. I wanted to change the world. And, I'm only partway there. But with your help. But I never wanted to be the kind of historian who, you know, you spend a semester or a year with a teacher and you never know where that teacher stands on the issues of the day. I did not want to be a neutral teacher. I didn't want to be a so-called objective teacher. I wanted my students to know exactly where I stood on, you know, whatever is going on in the world. I didn't want to go into the past and get lost. And, you know, that happens, you know, there are historians who go into the past. It's very interesting there. Then you never hear from them again. So, no, I wanted to go into history, and I wanted to come out with something that would be useful, something that would throw some light on what was going on in the world. I suppose the reason for this approach, the reason for this, you know, peculiar notion about history, was that, well, I'd lived a certain kind of life before I became a historian, before I even went to college. I had 10 years between high school and college. That should encourage some of you. There's a lot you can learn if you don't go to school. At the age of 18, I didn't go to college. I went to work in a shipyard. I was a shipyard worker for 3 years. In the working class neighborhood that I grew up in, a working class family, kids did not go to college at the age of 18. They went to work. And that's what I did. So I worked in a shipyard for 3 years, and I guess I developed there a kind of class consciousness. Do you know what I mean? A consciousness that the United States is not one big happy family. You know, it's very, very important to understand this because so many things in our culture want to tell us, you know, that we all have the same interests. You know, if Bush says, we're going to get a tax cut, great, we're all going to get a tax cut. No. No. You know, it's the culture uses phrases like, the national interest, as if there's a national interest, as if there isn't, you know, General Electric's interest and my interest, you see. But no, or they use the term national security, as if we all have the same notion of what national security means. For some people up there, national security means having more military bases around the world. For other people, national security means health care, housing, jobs, living a decent life. That's what security is. When you work at a hard job and you look around, and later on in life, if you run into people as I did, when I was teaching at Boston University, I had a lot of my students were the children of, you might say, successful people, professional people, you know, business people, doctors, lawyers. A lot of my students, and a number of them would say, not all of them, but a number of them would say, well, because we'd always have a discussion in my class about class. And some of my students would say, well, in America, if you work hard, you will make it. If you work hard, you will be successful. If you work hard, you know, I knew this was not true. You know, I knew how hard my father had worked. I knew how hard my mother had worked. And no, they didn't make it. in the normal sense of what success is. And on the other hand, I saw people, I didn't really meet them myself. I saw them in the movies. I saw them in the magazine covers, and people who were rich and prosperous, and I couldn't tell what kind of work they did. And I early on decided that, the society is divided into classes. You know, there are people who work very, very hard and make very, very little, you know, and there are people who don't work very hard. Or if they work, sometimes you find out their work is not good for the rest of us. They produce dangerous things. So when I began to study history, I came to history with this kind of consciousness. I knew that the 55 men who gathered in Philadelphia to draw up the Constitution did not represent the American people. They were rich white men. You know, it was not, this was not a multicultural group. There were no women there. There were no black people there. There were no Native Americans there. There were no poor people there. And they did not draw up a constitution to benefit everybody. Now, there's a great, I have a tendency in our society to make big deals of things that are little deals. We make big deals of the Constitution. In the year 1987, some of you who are old enough to remember it, that was 1987. I know all you high school kids remember that year, 1987. And it was the year of the bicentennial of the Constitution, 200 years after 1787, right? So there's a big celebration. The Constitution, all over the country, there were all these, all this hullabaloo about the Constitution. What a wonderful, wonderful document it was. And the president at that time, you may vaguely remember him, Ronald Reagan, the president, please. He's Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan was so overcome by the Constitution that he wrote an essay. Hard to believe, right? He wrote an essay for some, scholarly publication. I think it was Parade magazine. In it, he wrote that the Constitution is such a perfect document, it could only have been written with the guiding hand of God. That's awesome. God. God took time out of her busy schedule to say, to fashion the Constitution of the United States. What hubris, what arrogance. We still have that, God. Is on our side. I was listening to Bob Dylan's poem, a song, right? With God on our side. Really, go back and find it. Find Dylan's song, With God on Our Side. There was that year when Reagan wrote that wonderful essay. That year, there was only one dissenting voice in the upper reaches of the American government about the Constitution, and that was the voice of the one black member of the Supreme Court, Thurgood Marshall. And he made a speech. He made a speech in which he said, in effect, what are you all getting excited about? The Constitution was a pro-slavery document, which is what it was, of course. The Constitution legitimized slavery. The Constitution had a provision for the return of fugitive slaves to their masters wherever they were apprehended in the country. The Constitution considered black slaves as 3/5 of a person. This is, The Constitution did not represent all of us, all of the American people. The Constitution was drawn up to serve the class interests of the people who were there in Philadelphia. It was drawn up to serve the interests of the slave owners and the bondholders and the merchants and the expansionists to set up a strong central government. You know, at first, I remember going to school and saying, a strong central government, that's good. Well, it depends. It depends on what the government does with that strength. You know, it's like today, the United States is, a very, very powerful country. That's wonderful to live in such a very powerful country. Really? Depends on what this country does with that power. No. And what the Constitution wanted the government to do with this new strong central power was to make sure it was able to put down rebellions and revolts. Because the year before the making of the Constitution, and you won't hear this connection made, I assure you, in most schools. I'm not talking about the schools that you go to, but I know. But those other schools. Generally, in the schools of this country, you will not hear the connection made between Shays' Rebellion, the rebellion of farmers in western Massachusetts, and the making of the Constitution. As some of you may recall Shays' Rebellion, like it was on a multiple choice test or something, you know. It was a rebellion of thousands and thousands of farmers in western Massachusetts in 1786, rebelling against the rich of Massachusetts who controlled the legislature. Many of them were veterans of the Revolutionary War, and they'd been given pieces of land, and now that land is being taxed heavily, and they couldn't pay the taxes, and so their land and their farms were being taken away from them. They were being mortgaged away, and so they gathered around the courthouses in thousands, and they would not let the court proceedings go on. They did it in town after town after town. That was Shays' Rebellion. Finally, it was crushed by the army sent out, you know, from Boston. But it put a scare into the Founding Fathers. And the Founding Fathers decided, no, we have to have a government that's strong enough to put down rebellion. And so that was the idea of having a new, strong, central government. Interestingly enough, the veterans of the Revolutionary War got the same treatment that veterans of wars get. Talk about connecting the past and the present. You can find a persistent thread from the Revolutionary War to the Gulf War, going through all the other wars, of the betrayal of veterans. They come back from the war, they've been given great promises, and then they find that the government is not going to take care of them, and the government, you know, is going to not fulfill the promises it made. And this is what veterans have found out again and again. The veterans of World War I were promised a bonus, and when the Depression hit in the early 1930s, the veterans desperately needed that bonus that had been promised by Congress, and it was not there. The kids did not have enough to eat. And so veterans from all over the country traveled to Washington, came from all over the country. They rode the rails, they walked, they got here in Washington by hook or crook, and they set up tents across the Potomac River from the Capitol to demand that Congress pay their bonus. Congress wouldn't do it. Instead, the army was sent out to break up their tent colony, to spread tear gas, to shoot and drive them away. And what happened to the veterans of Vietnam who developed Agent Orange as a result of the chemical spray that the United States Army was using in Vietnam? And hundreds of thousands of veterans. And what happened to the veterans of the Gulf War? They say, oh, well, we only lost 200 men in the first Gulf War in 1991. But after the Gulf War, 550,000 soldiers received disability benefits from the Veterans Administration for injuries and sickness that came as a result of that war. And what are they, and how are they going to treat the veterans of this war who are already getting sick? You're not hearing that story very much in the papers, but there's sickness among the GIs in Iraq. Well, of course there's sickness. With all of that high technological, chemical stuff that we're using, depleted uranium, radioactive materials, is it any wonder that these GIs are coming back sick? And what is going to happen to them? So yes, I want to draw a connection, and I want to show the persistence of certain things over time. The treatment of veterans, the class character of the government, the government of slave owners and merchants and manufacturers, even after slavery was done away with, that still remained a government of the very rich, and it remains a government of the very rich today. And the interests, nobody can tell me that the interests of George Bush and the interests of most of the American people are the same. Those kids who go to your school you mentioned, whose parents earn $12,000 a year, their interests are not the same as the interests of the people in the White House. And so we can't expect those people in the White House to care about what happens to the ordinary people of this country. So yes, history is can be useful. History can suggest things to us about what is going on today. If you don't know any history, it's as if you were born yesterday. If you were born yesterday, and the president gets up before a microphone and says, we must go to war for democracy, for liberty, to liberate these people in this other country. If you don't have any history, if you were born yesterday, well, you have no way of checking up on this. Oh, you will believe the president. He's the president. He knows. Well, if you knew some history, you would know how often it turned out the presidents didn't know. Or if they knew, they didn't care. And so, yes, you have to know the history of the United States. If you hear the president say, you know, we're occupying Iraq to liberate the people and to create democracy there. Sounds reasonable if you have no history. If you know some history and you look back over the history of American occupations and American military interventions, and you see how often we have brought democracy and liberty to those countries we have invaded and occupied, no. If the American people as a whole knew this history, Bush would be out on his ear in 5 minutes. Really? No. Just a little slice of that history, which I can't resist. In 1898, the United States went to war in Cuba against Spain, Spanish-American War. Why did we go in? To liberate the Cubans from Spanish rule. Really? That's what we said. And it's true that the Cubans were suffering under Spanish rule, just as the Iraqis were suffering under Saddam Hussein. So we go in to Cuba and drive the Spaniards out and drive ourselves in. Spain is out, we are in. Spain is out, and the American corporations rush into Cuba. United Fruit, the American banks, the American railroads, and from that point on, Cuba is virtually a colony of the United States. When I hear that, oh, the United States is writing a constitution for Cuba, that's a laugh. You know, we are writing a constitution for Cuba? We're not even observing our own constitution. And besides, since when does having a constitution guarantee liberty and democracy? It's always a way of deceiving people. You know, you write out a document and you give it to them. You say, now you have democracy. And we made sure that we wrote important provisions into the Cuban Constitution in 1898. Yeah, we wrote a provision in guaranteeing that the United States could send the army into Cuba anytime it felt like. We wrote a provision in for the United States to establish a military base in Cuba, which we still have today. I mean, that's what Guantanamo is, a military base that the United States has had for over 100 years. We did not bring democracy to Cuba. For 100 years, Cuba had, for a long, long time, Cuba, well, let's say 70 years. Cuba lived under a dictatorship with American corporations profiteering in Cuba, with the rich Americans going to Cuba for gambling and prostitution. And I mean, that's what Cuba was. That's how much democracy and liberation we brought to Cuba, you know. Unfortunately, then, Castro came and ruined it all, you know. And that's what we had against him. He ruined it all. You know, it was a wonderful playground for Americans. And now they've taken away the seesaws, you know. And, so I won't talk about the American occupation of Haiti or the American occupation of the Dominican Republic or the American occupation of the Philippines, which lasted 46 years, and we're still not out of there. No, our record as an occupying power, you know, is not a record that we can be proud of. And so if you knew that history and listened to the President of the United States, you know, forget it. No. There must be other motives. Really? You mean there could be other motives? You mean the United States could have motives other than liberty and democracy in sending its armies around the world? A little history would be helpful there. Yeah. Take Vietnam. We go into Vietnam to bring liberty and democracy to the people of Vietnam. Well, if you read the memos that were sent secretly in the high echelons of government from the State Department to the National Security Council and back, these things came out when the Pentagon Papers were illegally released in an act of civil disobedience in 1971. And you could read those memos in the Pentagon Papers. And what do those memos say when they talked about why the United States was in Vietnam? They didn't talk about liberty and democracy. They talked about tin, rubber, and oil. And it doesn't take too much investigation to come to the conclusion that behind all this talk about liberty and democracy, behind all this talk is oil, business, profits, not the security of the people of Iraq, and certainly not the security of the United States. This occupation of Iraq is a very brutal occupation. The American people are only getting a little bit of the sense of what that occupation is like. And back in World War II, we talked about the Nazis occupying the countries of Europe. I mean, we talked right after that about the Russians occupying, you know, Hungary and Czechoslovakia and so on. Those occupations, we're bad. Our occupations are good. But if you read, just occasionally it comes in the press about things that happen, you know, in this occupation. CBS News, and you have to read carefully, because these things that give you a glimpse of the truth, they appear and they disappear. Really. And yet they appear and disappear so quickly, 2 days later, you're not even sure you really read it, you know? So you have to be a clipper of newspapers like I am. You have to, you know, fiendishly cut up all the stuff from the papers and put it in your files so you won't think it never happened, you see. And CBS reported, you know, in July of this year, Amnesty International is looking into a number of cases of suspected torture in Iraq by American authorities. One such case involves Khaisan al-Abali. His house was razed by American soldiers who came in shooting and arrested him and his 80-year-old father. They shot and wounded his brother. The three men were taken away. Khaisan says his interrogators stripped him naked and kept him awake for more than a week, either standing or on his knees, bound hand and foot with a bag over his head. Khaisan told his captors, "I don't know anything. I don't know what you want. I have no idea what you want. I have nothing. I asked them to kill me." After 8 days, they let him and his father go. U.S. officials did not respond to repeated requests to discuss the case. And you may remember that the United States government put out a most wanted list, and they had playing cards to represent, you know, the top Iraqi leaders, Saddam Hussein and his sons and other, and they had playing cards representing them. You know, it's a lot of fun, war, you say. And the playing cards, you know, were headed, you know, most wanted. You know, these are wanted. Well, somebody interviewed a soldier in Iraq with the 101st Airborne. He said, "I have my most wanted list. I have my playing cards, you know." And he says, "My playing cards have the pictures of Donald Rumsfeld, George Bush, Paul Wolfowitz, Paul Bremer, you know." So that's an occupation. Not something we Americans could be proud of. We don't want to live in a country where our government and our army and our soldiers do these things. And you know, soldiers follow orders, and they do these things. Ordinary guys go into the military, and the military does a job on their heads, and they end up doing terrible things. And you know, I was in the military, I was in the Air Force. Did I tell you that? I will. Yeah, I was in the Air Force. And let's see, what war was that? It was the Spanish-American War. Yeah. It was World War II. No, not the Spanish-American War. Yeah. But I know what happens to people in the military and how the training that you get until you're not thinking for yourselves anymore, and then they just tell you to go out, you know, and bomb this place, and you have no idea what you're doing, have no idea what you're bombing. You don't know who's dying down there. You're dropping bombs from 30,000 feet, from 6 miles up in the air. You don't see any human beings down below. You don't hear any screams. You don't see any blood. You don't see any mangled limbs. And so you go and you do all of this, and you come back. Ah, yeah, successful mission. You may remember during the first Gulf War, they show, you know, pictures on television of pilots coming back happily. We succeeded here. We dropped our bombs here. Mission accomplished. No, but they had no idea, you know, what they were doing. They didn't see these people up close. No. There's one picture that I clipped from the newspaper. It shows this Iraqi kid who is an Iraqi boy in a hospital, and he lost both of his legs in a bomb strike yesterday. This is from the New York Times, you know, in April. So this is what occupation means. This is what war means. They're talking about a war on terrorism, which is ridiculous. This has not been a war on terrorism. This has been a war to increase terrorism. Because the more you bomb a country and the more you subject its people to humiliation, the more terrorists you create. And war itself is terrorism. So, if we could only get that message across to people that war is terrorism. If terrorism is defined by the deliberate killing of innocent people in order to achieve some objective, some political objective, I mean that's what terrorists do. Well, then that's what governments do. They'll say, oh, it's not deliberate. We don't mean to kill these people. Just an accident. An accident after accident after accident after accident. No, it's not an accident. That doesn't mean it's deliberate. It does not mean that the pilot wants to kill these kids, these people down below. It just means that he doesn't really care. He's just going to do his job. It's going to be inevitable. No matter how so-called smart the bomb is, inevitable that civilians will be killed. How come we dropped all those smart bombs in Afghanistan and killed over 3,000 civilians? How come we dropped all these smart precision bombs in Iraq and have killed we don't know how many civilians, 5,000, 10,000, in a very short time? That's terrorism. And we stand against terrorism committed against us, and we can stand against terrorism committed by us. I think one of the most important things for people to learn is to go beyond the nationalism that we're all brought up with. The idea that, we are the greatest. We are number one. We should be proud that we are the strongest. We are the toughest. We have the most nuclear weapons. We have the most military bases everywhere. That's something to be proud of, really. No. If we were number one in healthcare, that would be something to be proud of. No, if we were number one in giving our billions, not for war, but for people in Africa who need drugs to combat malaria and tuberculosis, that's what we should be number one in. We shouldn't want to be number one as a military superpower. We should want to be number one as a humanitarian superpower. That's what we should be doing. When I say overcome nationalism, we're imbued with it from the time we're this high. We go to school and we pledge allegiance to the flag, and then recruiters come around to the high schools and they show all these movies and on television and so on about military heroism. And so it's no wonder the kids grow up thinking, wow, this is a great thing to do. Go to war. Become a military hero. And get the idea that somehow we are better than other people. Get the idea that the lives of our people are more important than the lives of other people.